From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project with Allison Stewart and Luke Burbank.
It's Friday the 13th. Ooh,
scary
times. Welcome to the Bryant Park Project. I'm Luke Burbank. Hello, Allison Stewart.
Hello, Luke Burbank. Hey, everybody. The biggest story is not that it's Friday the 13th, but actually that it's the House vote to bring troops home by April 1st, 2008. We will discuss. And the most interesting story, Luke, I think, is that Tom Tancredo, a Republican presidential candidate, apparently does like black people. He showed up at the NAACP forum, the only Republican to do so.
And he won because he was the only one debating. He also, this is an interesting note, aside from Bill Clinton, he could be our second black president, Tom Tancredo.
I don't think he knows that, but...
Well, maybe we can tell him that sometime. We've also got a live music set from Teddy Thompson, which we're very excited about. First, though, let's hear about the news from Matthew Daniel Martinez.
Thank you, Luke. Thank you, Allison. Last night, the House of Representatives passed legislation requiring U.S. troop withdrawal from Iraq to begin in the next 120 days and to be completed by April. The vote was largely along party lines, 223 to 201. Allison and Luke will review this week in Iraq, coming up in a few minutes. The vote came on the same day that President Bush insisted the U.S. must succeed in Iraq and has vowed to push ahead in spite of a report released Thursday that shows the Iraqi government has not yet fully met any of the 18 political, military, and economic goals set by Congress. UN inspectors are heading to Pyongyang to supervise the shutdown of North Korea's nuclear reactor. The chief U.S. envoy, Christopher Hill, wants the reactor completely disabled by the end of the year. New Mexico governor and presidential hopeful Bill Richardson says he didn't mean to demean anybody when he used a Spanish word for gay. It happened more than a year ago on the Don Imus show in response to a comment that he was not really Hispanic. Richardson wonders why he's being criticized for it now. He thinks other campaigns are a little worried about him. Nine people filed a $1.3 million lawsuit Thursday against tuberculosis patient Andrew Speaker for possibly exposing them to the disease on a commercial flight from Prague to Montreal. Eight of those filing the suit were passengers on the flight with Speaker, and the ninth is a brother and a roommate of one of the passengers. A not-so-wholesome story now. The CEO of Whole Foods, John Mackey, was called out for posting disparaging comments on internet financial forums about rival Wild Oats Markets, saying that the company's stock was overpriced and that the company had no value and no future. Then in February, Whole Foods announced it would buy Wild Oats for about $565 million. Whole Foods says that the postings are being taken out of context. And Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix raked in a whopping $44.8 million for the biggest Wednesday opening ever. The numbers include midnight screenings in the United States and Canada that brought in $12 million. The previous record for a Wednesday in the United States was 2004's Spider-Man 2. And that opened with $40.4 million. I'm Matt Martinez. Those are the latest headlines from NPR News.
Thank you, Matt. They got 11 of my dollars, Harry Potter, on Wednesday, I have to admit. Hey, so I want to follow up one of those stories that Matt told us about. The House has voted that April 1st, 2008 is the day when U.S. forces should be out of Iraq, but that really doesn't mean a whole heck of a lot.
I mean, that is April Fool's Day.
That is not lost on me either. That doesn't mean much unless the Senate agrees, but most folks think that is highly unlikely. Here's what President Bush said to Congress yesterday.
The Iraqis do not want U.S. troops patrolling their cities forever, any more than the American people do. But we need to ensure that when U.S. forces do pull back, the terrorists and extremists cannot take control. The strategy that General Petraeus and the troops he commands are now carrying out is the best opportunity to bring us to this point. So I ask Congress to provide them with the time and resources they need.
You know, it seems like all of the news out of Capitol Hill this week, at least all the big stuff, has been really Iraq-related. There's all this pressure on the president to decide if he's going to pull out or not, and he keeps saying, we got to wait to see if this surge of troops is working, and we need a full report. That's in September. Give me until September. Meanwhile, in Iraq, things are blowing up, literally.
It's a difficult part about getting your arms or your head around all the news that comes out of Iraq is that it just keeps coming. Car bomb explodes. Congress votes on something. A cleric says something else. And it's hard to keep track of it all, frankly.
Right, which brings us to a segment that we're going to do maybe on Fridays.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, seems like it. To kind of try to put this stuff in context. Because maybe if you kind of hear all the little drip-drip parts of this story at once, at least to what happened in the previous week, you'll be able to kind of understand things a little better. And we have quite cleverly named the segment The Week in Iraq. All right, so here we go. Last Monday, July 9th, here in the States, it was the start of a two-week debate on Capitol Hill over paying for the war. There were some high-level Republicans like a guy named Pete Domenici who started to defect. Over in Baghdad, at least four people died in roadside bombs. 29 people were picked up, 29 bodies, that is, from the streets after some weekend violence.
All right. Tuesday, July 10th, 17 people died in explosions and shooting across Iraq. Five Iraqi soldiers died in a gunfight. Three Iraqi police killed by gunmen on the highway. In Baghdad, suicide car bomb exploded at a checkpoint that killed one, injured another eight. On top of that, 20 mortar rounds and Katyusha rockets struck the Green Zone Tuesday afternoon. One American service member died. Two others died as well in that attack.
Now, on Wednesday, July 11th, it was really kind of a big day in politics over here in the U.S. In D.C., senators told Stephen Hadley, that's Mr. Bush's top security advisor, that they don't want to wait until September for a course change in Iraq. That's when this big report's coming out. The president keeps saying, let's wait till September to make any decisions.
Fast forward to Thursday, a solid majority of Senate Republicans, they actually stood by the president's Iraq policy and blocked consideration of a plan to give U.S. troops more time between their combat tours. But Democrats drew fresh Republican support for other proposals as they pushed to change the administration's war strategy.
And in D.C., the White House released a report that was ordered by lawmakers, kind of a mini benchmark checkup.
Yeah.
And they basically found that out of these benchmarks, maybe half of them are being met. But in a minute, we'll talk about what their definition of success was.
And today, an Iraqi reporter working for The New York Times was shot on his way to work in Baghdad. And as we mentioned already, the House representatives voted for troop withdrawal by April 1st.
So, Ali, give me the kind of digest, at least politically.
All right. If you look at that whole week in Iraq, politically, it's the president won for thwarting troop rotation. Democrats won for the House vote to pull out. A draw, we'll say, on the benchmarks, because eight were considered unsatisfactory, eight satisfactory, two were given the heading too early to tell. But I will say that some critics questioned the administration's definition of satisfactory.
All right, so it's kind of a draw on the D.C. side of things. And in Iraq, on the ground, it looks like it's still a pretty deadly place for U.S. soldiers, but also a lot of Iraqi soldiers are being drawn into this. One of the sort of things that was slightly positive for the White House about the benchmarks was that they have found that certain kinds of car bombings and other attacks are sort of going down. So maybe you could say it was a somewhat quiet week on the ground. I guess that would be the kind of wrap-up for that. Speaking, though, of on the ground in Baghdad, NPR's Rachel Martin, also friend of the show, Rachel Martin, just got back from a month in Baghdad where she was reporting for NPR, and she joins us by telephone now. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Luke.
How you doing?
I'm doing okay. How are you guys?
We're all right. We're all right.
We're in awe of you and what you spend your time doing, frankly. I am, anyway.
Rachel, what is it like walking around in Baghdad, actually physically being in Baghdad? Is it just totally terrifying all the time?
Well, I wish I could tell you what it was like to walk around Baghdad. I didn't get to do a whole lot of walking around Baghdad. And, you know, it doesn't matter how many times people tell you this is what it's like when you go over there, and these are the constraints on how you do your job and how you report that story. It's just a different beast altogether. When something happens, when an explosion happens, you don't just run outside and go to the site of the bombing and talk to people about what they saw and build your own impressions upon what you see, smell, touch, and feel. You just don't do that. So I didn't spend a whole lot of time walking around Baghdad. When you get to do that, it's usually with the military and under a lot of security. And the only time I really got to do that, I mean, you can walk around kind of where our NPR compound is. There's like, you know, a couple of blocks you can cruise around, but that doesn't really give you a very accurate impression of what's going on. The only other time that I was kind of out in the Wild West, so to speak, was when I went on a walk with General David Petraeus, and he's the head of U.S. operations there, U.S. troops there, and it was like a half-day embed, and we went walking around a neighborhood of Baghdad called Qadamiya, and this is supposed to be a pretty safe place. It's in large part because it's controlled by Shiite militias. And, you know, we walked around the main street, and we saw a market. We couldn't really get close enough to see how many people were actually in the market. But, you know, the general met with people, shook hands, stopped and had tea. But we were with 30 very well-armed soldiers. And this was, you know, this was a big deal. It takes a lot of security for the general to go for a little walk around Baghdad. So when you get out, it's for short periods of time, and it's very well orchestrated. And it was only a few hours after we left that neighborhood that a bomb went off in that same place, you know, a few blocks away, and killed more than 10 people. So it's still a really risky thing to do.
So then you came from being in Baghdad, which is super dangerous, back to the States, and you told me the other day you went from Baghdad to basically Babies R Us with your sister-in-law. It's just totally weird to be back in America and kind of walking around.
Oh, it always is, you know, when you go to a place where you're kind of walking along this precipice of life and death all the time, and you never really exhale. You're kind of always on your guard, and you're always kind of holding your breath to a certain degree without suffocating yourself. And when you get out, you exhale and you realize, oh, I've been holding my breath for a month.
Oh.
And my brother and his wife just had their first baby, so literally I was picked up from the airport and we went to Babies R Us. And it's, you know, it takes a few days to kind of re-enter life in America and recalibrate yourself. But, you know, I'm not complaining. It's nice to be somewhere where you don't kind of hear the cacophony of bombs going off all day long.
Rachel, are you able and are you interested at all in the news coming out of the United States when you are fully involved in your reporting in Baghdad? Do you have a hunger for that at all? And how easy or difficult is it for you to get?
You mean besides the stuff about Iraq, like
yeah,
other news?
Yeah, other news.
Well, I have to admit that when we were over there, it was when this whole Paris Hilton thing was going down.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
And it made it all the way to Iraq.
And, you know.
Oh, you just gave me a headache.
In a way, it was like, okay, you know, we can just kind of check out of the daily car bomb, sectarian violence, and distract ourselves with this ridiculous story. And then in this other bizarre twist, it actually became part of our story because we were checking the wires for the daily news, and you type in Iraq and you see what comes up, and there were all these stories about all these U.S. soldiers in Baghdad who were writing Paris Hilton while she was in jail.
Oh,
it was a bizarre confluence of the two stories. And we thought, you know, what if we just went out and tried to do some interviews with Iraqis about what they think about Paris Hilton, which we did not do. But I guess the answer to your story, to your question, is that it can be a little welcome distraction from time to time.
You know, I had to make a promise to Allison after the last week's show that we would never talk about Paris Hilton again.
I'm so sorry.
And of all the places I thought it would come up, the during Iraq coverage was not the spot I expected it.
She's like my Voldemort, the one who shall not be named on the Brian Park Project. But we're giving you a pass, Rachel, because you do such amazing work.
Because you just almost got killed for a month.
Exactly. Can I ask you a question about some of the news that we talked about when we were looking at that bigger picture that week in Iraq? And I'm always struck when it comes over the wires, you hear sort of a breathless report about there was a Katyusha rocket in the green zone, the fortified green zone.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, from what I understand, that has become an incredibly dangerous area. Why?
I have to tell you, and I had some firsthand experience with that. When you go on an embed, you have to usually spend the night inside the green zone. Our office, NPR's office, is outside of that green zone, so we have to spend the night there. And on one of those occasions, when I was waiting for my flight out, a mortar round came in and into the green zone and hit just, you know, probably 20 feet from the little trailer where we were sleeping. No one was injured, but, you know, it's kind of a wake-up call, and you think, this is the green zone, and I hear that this kind of stuff is happening here, but it was a very real interaction with that. And, you know, it's put a lot of people on guard, and people speculate about why that's happening. Either they're becoming better shots. It's hard to say. They're becoming more bold, the insurgents, but it's definitely not the safe kind of green peaceful zone that it once was a few years ago. And it just signals even more so that the front lines of this whole war are so ambiguous and so undefined that even in this kind of safe area, things are not so safe.
Hey, Rachel, just a quick question. We only have about 30 seconds left, but you were embedded with soldiers over there. What are they saying to you? Do they feel optimistic?
Well, a lot of it, this is their job, right? So they're fighting because this is the task that's been set to them, and they have to stay optimistic because that's how they cope and that's how they deal with this. But, you know, you talk to them a little longer and they'll reveal to you that it's tough. It's tough. They see some frustrating experiences. They've had a lot of frustrating experiences training Iraqi security forces to take over, and that's really where they see their exit strategy, and that's, they don't have a whole lot of confidence in those forces to take over when the U.S. begins to withdraw.
Well, Rachel, we're glad you're back safe.
NPR's yes, Rachel.
Rachel Martin, thanks for talking to us.
You bet. Thanks, guys.
You're listening to the Bryant Park Project. You're listening to the Bryant Park Project. I'm Allison Stewart. And Luke, I'm supposed to pay attention to Barry Bonds this weekend, right?
Yes.
Why?
You are supposed to pay rapt attention to
everything. I know a little bit why.
But his pumpkin-sized head and body does.
How'd it get that big?
Well, that's what we're going to talk about a little bit. Yeah, this weekend, Barry Bonds goes into a homestand against the Los Angeles Dodgers. He sits at 751 home runs, which is four shy of Hank Aaron's all-time home run record. And this is pretty much baseball's most hallowed record. I mean, arguably anyway, there's the Joe DiMaggio hitting streak, but let's just say this is one of sports' biggest records. And the fact that this guy, who pretty much everyone in the solar system thinks cheated, is
and they don't like him a whole lot.
Yeah, he's not nice to the media generally, yeah. Which is a good way to not get any kind of good coverage. And so anyway, he is about to break this record, and it is very, very awkward making for Major League Baseball, for, you know, sort of people who watch the game. How are you supposed to feel about this? Well, on the line, we've got a guy who I wanted to get this show so that I could interview this guy because I'm such a fan of his blog. Will Leach from Deadspin.com joins us. Hi, Will.
Hey, hello, hello. Thank you for your very kind words.
Thanks for coming on the show. So Barry Bonds, it's funny because, you know, he's getting close to this record. It seems like so much of this is going to come down to in terms of the reaction. Is he at home or on the road when it happens? He better pray that he's in San Francisco, right?
Yeah, it'll definitely be strange to see. In contrast to just about every other record-breaking performance, to have a man actually booed and people throwing fake syringes at him, that seems like kind of against the idea of celebration you usually see in situations like that.
Because, like, the only place where people are still nice to him is San Francisco. And if he does it, like, he's going to be in Chicago later this week, and that doesn't seem like a place where he wants to break the record. Is there any chance that someone might actually throw the ball back?
If someone did that, it would be a very amusing contrast to when Tim Fornaris, the groundskeeper at Busch Stadium, when Mark McGwire broke the original single season record, and, you know, he gave the ball back to McGwire and gave it to the Hall of Fame. It was a very heartwarming story, and this would actually be ironically heartwarming in like the meaner, nastier way. And but it's funny because like you talk to a lot of the people that work in collectibles, and they actually are not expecting this ball to be like one of the greater to fetch one of the greater prices, because it's just it's just not considered like this really wonderful thing that everyone feels joyous about. But that said, I'd be pretty surprised if someone had the intestinal fortitude to throw something like that.
That would be the ultimate throwback of all.
Like
you would be
that person would become a hero to a lot of people, and a lot of people also call him very dumb.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So Bud Selig is the commissioner of Major League Baseball, for those who don't know, and he's in a weird spot because he is good friends with Hank Aaron, and he's kind of a stickler. Well, somewhat of – he seems like a stickler. He seems like kind of a square, like a guy who wouldn't be into celebrating the feats of someone who might have been a cheater. And yet he's the commissioner of Major League Baseball. What's his plan? Is he going to show up there? Is he going to give him a trophy? Is he going to give him a hug?
He hasn't officially said. There have been reports that say that he will be there, and I suspect he probably will. But in a certain way, you can – almost say that Selig deserves to be there. The Bonds is almost the golem he created, the monster that with so much baseball was so behind on steroids in the 90s that this is kind of what Selig and his kind of there's a lot of home runs, the ratings are good, so let's not look behind the curtain. That this is almost sort of the natural thing that happens when they close their eyes for so long. And I think what's funny is that people. It's not really news for Selig to be there. The news is if Selig isn't. And I think what people were hoping, a lot of people were hoping, was because Selig has been so behind on this and really has never taken the strongest stance as I think is, it's all just kind of an empty words without action. So I think for him to actually have, if he would have actually made a stance and said, I will not actually be there for this, that's what people were kind of hoping would happen. But I think as a commissioner of baseball, I don't think he can make that kind of stand. But it's interesting you talk about Hank Aaron because I really feel, Hank Aaron is adamant about he said that he will not be there when Bonds breaks the record, and he actually is not a fan of Bonds and believes he did artificially enhance himself to get there. And I really think Aaron really drove kind of the debate on this a lot more than people realize. Mm-hmm. I think if Aaron, because he before anyone even like thought about the idea of like, oh, would Selig be there? How will they celebrate it? Aaron came out very strongly initially and said, I do not want this man to break my record, and if he breaks it, I won't be there for it.
Yeah.
And
Aaron
is so respected. Like, he's very beloved. So I think that really drove the conversation on this a lot of ways. I think if he had said from the beginning, hey, Bonds is a great player, I'm very happy for him, and I'm happy to give the record to such a great player, I think that maybe we wouldn't be having some of these conversations now. I think Aaron really, from the beginning, long before even people were really even quite discussing this, said, I'm not a fan of this, I don't want to be a part. And I think everyone's kind of just reacting to that.
Speaking of Hank Aaron, I just think that there's a simple solution. You bring Hank Aaron out of retirement, you give him like underhand pitches, and you let him hit 20 more home runs. Problem solved, bro.
That would be very enjoyable. Unfortunately, wouldn't it be ironic if he did that and it turned out, no, he tested positive for steroids.
Wrong. I don't know anything about sports, and that's wrong.
Listen, Will Leach from Deadspin.com, if you're not reading it every day, there's something wrong with you. Will, thanks for coming on the show.
Of course, thanks for having me.
Appreciate it.
Little bit of business news. Jane Magazine is dead. Publisher Condé Nast announced this week the August issue will be the magazine's last. And trust me, the news is a little sad for all those young women who were so grateful for seeing themselves when they curled up with Jane and its predecessor, Sassy, both created by Jane Pratt, a kind of unusual person who edited two unusual women's mags, one that didn't make you feel bad about yourself unless feeling bad felt good, as in having one beer or maybe five. And it had articles and interviews that made you believe the editors were real people who might actually get nervous or starstruck, as Ms. Pratt did when she interviewed them, like when she did this with the band Ween.
Okay. So. But now that you're on Elektra, do you think that, are you going to do your next album the same way, still the same way, or are you going to now like fly to the Bahamas and go in a big studio and do all that?
Now we're going to record the next album in Maui, 48-track studio.
Glad to hear it.
No,
okay.
We want to get like Michael Bolton's backing band.
Good.
That woman was the editor of a major magazine. A lot of people said that Jane, the magazine, was over 2 years ago this month when Ms. Pratt left, pushed out, left, you know, one of those quit-fire things. And the magazine became more of a lame Jane, concentrating on beauty tips more than, you know, how to write your congressman. And it seemed the Janiacs agreed. They didn't buy the new Jane.
Wait, the Janiacs?
I made that up. Figuratively or literally. You know what? Someone who was there for the entire ride was Karen Yampalsky. She worked at Jane Magazine since day one as Jane's Pratt assistant before they both left in July of 2005. She also worked at Sassy, and you can now add novelist to her resume. She just released a book, a novel called Falling Out of Fashion. Got great reviews. And Luke, check this out. The book is about the life and career of an editor of a fashion magazine called Jill, who faces an evil and well-coiffed empire only to end up getting the boot, which causes the magazine to fold. Karen, you're so prescient. You're like a mind reader that the story of your book actually happened this week.
Yeah, if you've read the book, in my book it actually happened faster. So my only shock at the news was that it took so long in coming.
In its heyday, can you describe for me what I would have seen in the average issue of Jane, that I might not have seen in another woman's magazine?
There were, it's really what you wouldn't have seen. It's maybe easier way to go. You wouldn't have seen any diets. You wouldn't have seen any stories about, you know, how to get a man or how to keep a man happy. You would have seen things, emerging bands, technology, things you wouldn't have normally seen in a typical women's magazine.
Why do you think the fans of Jane and Sassy were so devoted to the magazine?
Well, it really, both of them spoke to a group of women that were not really being addressed elsewhere. These were magazines that assumed their readers were smart, confident, and were interested in other things, not just how to have a boyfriend, how to lose weight, and fashion and beauty tips. And it approached them on their level and never spoke down to them and didn't preach and with a sense of humor.
One of the things in your novel, as you describe this young woman becoming this editor and the kind of magazine she wants to make, is how she's treated within the whole structure of this big corporate empire. And I want to read this line from page 3. When Nestor Medium first bought us, we moved to the 15th floor, sharing it with Fashionista. But that didn't last long. I could tell by the Fashionista's consistently disgusted scowls that they couldn't bear our tattoos, piercings, cheap multi-hued haircuts, and general slovenliness for long. Before I knew it, we were being kicked downstairs, shoved in a corner behind the cafeteria between the supply guy and the check cashing lady. Now, it couldn't be any clearer where Jill fit into the hierarchy of Nestrum Magazine Empire. Was there an incredible pressure at Jane and Sassy to conform, to be more like the other magazines?
No, well, at Sassy, not really, because until all the advertisers started pulling out because of the, there was a boycott by the Moral Majority who are outraged that Sassy was teaching teens how to practice safe sex. But at Jane, once Jane was bought by a company called Condé Nast, which is a really, big and prestigious media company.
We call them Condé Nasty when I used to work
someplace
else.
Miss Jackson, if you're nasty.
But the editorial staff of Jane, really, we were like fish out of water because, we weren't high fashion. There was plenty of blue hair. We were a little slobby. And when we we were bought by Condé Nast, we were put on a floor with W magazine. So I don't know if you're familiar with W, but
let's put it this way. Posh in Beck's and sort of Mapplethorpe-like photos are in W right now.
Left out. But so the staff of Jane, we didn't really fit in, and that is not far from the truth at all. Nobody really wanted to be with us. And when we did end up on our own little floor with the cafeteria and the check casher.
And I have to point out, one of the most interesting things about your book that I had a conversation with you earlier this week, in full disclosure, is when you wrote this book, it was after Jane Pratt had been asked to leave, but you hadn't been asked to leave yet. So you actually...
The writing was on the wall. I assumed I was leaving, but nobody remembered to tell me. So I just kept going into work and said, I'll just sit here as long as I keep getting paid. And the idea had come to me actually months before that announcement. I was watching an incredible story unfold before my eyes, and I used that opportunity, I had nothing to do. So
you wrote this book.
Mm-hmm.
I love that you wrote this book while they were preparing to fire
you. Yeah, I hope they're not listening right now. But
are you in fashion anymore? Do you do this anymore?
No, obviously not. I am working in finance.
And do you think there's any book there?
You know,
maybe you can write about Torbs magazine.
Yeah.
Some other lame cover name.
I'm working for a monoline reinsurance company. So once I figure out what the heck that means, then maybe there I could find a book in it. But for now, we'll see. I'm enjoying it.
Karen, can I just ask you a question about the cover of your book?
Mm-hmm.
Is that depicting
you,
or is that depicting this fictional person named
I'm so
Jane?
Glad you asked me about the cover.
Because that chick is hot.
I hate it, but the cover is depicting the editor, Jill.
Oh, well, she can't get that mad at you then because you...
No, she's not. Plus, she's the heroine in the book. The editor is definitely the heroine. But, you know, a lot of people have said it's a blatant ripoff, that cover of The Devil Wears Prada, and I completely agree, and it was not my call. So I did fight against the cover. I thought we could be a little bit more creative.
But one of the things that was kind of good about it was, for you, is you were able to sell this book very quickly, correct?
Because of The Devil Wears Prada, yes, exactly. You know, it was coming on the heels of that. It's a completely different story. You know, it takes place in magazine publishing. But other than that, I think it's a really different story, just as fun, and certainly many evil characters. But the main character, the protagonist, you know, is really someone to root for and who accomplishes a lot. And it's about her and her rise and fall.
We've gotten some great reviews. A lot of people have said this is really smart chick lit. Karen Yampolsky, thanks for joining us and giving us the inside scoop on Jane Magazine. Rest in peace.
Thanks so much for having me.
Allison.
Yes.
It's time for my very favorite part of the show, which we've only done one time, actually. But I liked it a lot when we did it last time. I don't know if we have music or not, but let's try and do the ramble.
It makes me want to ramble when I hear the backbeat. All right, Colorado House Representative Tom Tancredo, the lone GOP candidate to show his face at the NAACP convention yesterday. He was sort of Cinderella among the debates. Not that there really was anybody for him to debate. He was the only Republican candidate who showed up. He got a standing ovation, won over the audience with a few wisecracks. He talked a lot about his strict immigration policy, and he stumbled onto the stage, apparently. He confused about where to stand in the middle of it all.
But they still gave him a standing ovation.
Yeah.
It was awesome. Miss New Jersey, Amy Palumbo, rhymes with Columbo. She was all over the news this week for some supposedly scandalous pictures of her.
Did you say scandal-ass?
No, I said scandalous. Get your mind out of the gutter. Apparently, though, someone was trying to blackmail her, and so she went on the Today Show, and they showed all the pictures, and they were totally fine.
They were just drunk party girl pictures. Who
yeah.
are you kidding? Allegedly drunk.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so she's now America's sweetheart. Everyone loves Amy Palumbo.
All right. Not everybody's loving the Black Entertainment Television cable channel. It has a new show this week called, not this week, it's going to be released in a couple weeks, actually, called Hot Ghetto Mess. Mm-hmm. And advertisers are pulling out because they say the content of the show is, quote, demeaning and vulgar. You can decide for yourself. Hot Ghetto Mess is all about home footage that viewers send in of themselves and man on the street videos and interviews. And it's what my grandma used to say. They show themselves acting a fool. So fill in the blank there. BET says the show is meant to expose behavior that is degrading and convince its viewers that, quote, we've got to do better.
You know, we were about to call this show Hot Ghetto Mess. I mean, that is we dodged a real bullet on that. And you know what? If I have one legacy as my time co-hosting this show, let it be this.
Hey, now walk it out.
This is Walk It Out by Unk. And what you're not seeing is that this song goes so nicely with this 1960s dance routine called Mexican Breakfast that Bob Fosse put together. Now, here's the thing. Mexican Breakfast was actually set to a piece of music that sounds a lot like this. All right.
I love it. The women have these beehive hairdos, these about 135% polyester pants with the flared legs.
Right, but what you got to understand now, I think we kind of got a little confused there. This is the original music to these ladies dancing in the 60s. But then you put Walk It Out under that, and they're dancing in perfect time. And, like, all my friends who never say anything about the blog are calling me going, what was that thing you had on the blog? And we thought, who the heck could be so smart slash have so much spare time as to figure this out? And it turns out that it's a lovely young lady named Judy Cutrone. Am I saying that right, Judy? She's putting together her next web video, which I think is going to be awesome. It's going to be an Ashford and Simpson song.
To bat Swan Lake.
All right.
Oh, Judy's on hold, apparently.
We're getting Judy here.
Should we track Judy down on vacation?
Oh! Hello?
Hello?
Hi, Judy.
Hi.
You're on the Bryant Park Project.
How are you?
Good. Thanks for coming on. So, seriously, how did you even ever think that possibly Unk was going to go good with this 1960s video?
It was just a weird, freaky coincidence. We were watching the original video with that Austin Powers music that I can vaguely hear over the background. And we were playing, Harlow in my office was playing this, hardcore rap song. And we just realized that it was going to go really well. And
so literally someone else was playing the music, someone else in the office was playing Unk,
yeah.
And it kind of floated over to where your cubicle was?
Yeah, well, yeah, we have a radio in our office, and we all listen to music, and that was the song that was playing, and we were looking at the video, and we noticed that it was matching up pretty well. We just thought it was very funny. So, you know, I got the original video from someone on YouTube and dubbed it over, and we didn't even realize how closely it was going to match up until we literally dropped the track over the video and put it up, and it matched perfectly. It was just one of those very weird things.
Your face, your MySpace page is hilarious. Some of the comments you're getting from people. There are people who haven't talked to you in years who are posting. My favorite is, Judy, this video is the new black.
Wow, I haven't even seen that yet. It's true. I've been getting messages from people that I haven't talked to in 2 or 3 years.
Do you have any plans for some awesome future mashups, like maybe Ginger Rogers set to Dem Franchise Boys or something?
I don't know. We'll have to see. I have about 50 subscribers now, which is a little terrifying. Just expecting something new. So we'll have to play with it in the office. Ironically, the day after we posted the video in the office, my boss blocked us from YouTube.
I wonder why.
Yeah, well, so I've been seeing these blogs. It's just like I saw that you guys picked it up, and I can't even watch it in at work. I'm the only person who can't watch it, and I'm like, this is very ironic.
Well,
so,
it's going over.
So it'll probably be on my own time that I'll have to find a new video to.
It's going over like gangbusters, Judy. Judy Cutrone, thanks for talking to us.
Sure, thank you.
All right, yeah, walk it on out now.
This is the Bryant Park Project. Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project. I'm Allison Stewart.
I'm Luke Burbank, still.
Singer-songwriter, producer as well, correct, Teddy?
Yeah, why not?
All right, he does it all. Teddy Thompson has a new album coming out next Tuesday. It's on the 17th. It's called Up Front and Down Low, and he's joining us in the studio today. We're so glad you could make it down today, Teddy.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Now, the album is a series of cover songs, except for one that you wrote. Oh, how did you whittle it down with so many amazing, and we should say country, songs? How did you whittle it down to the ones you chose for the record?
I had a few that were favorites from when as a kid that I loved, and then the rest of them I just bought CDs and started. It was a little project, I trawled through the backwoods of country music.
You don't sound like you're from the backwoods, though.
What?
I think people are probably wondering.
I'm from the backwoods of London. It's a little unusual, but I actually grew up on country music, which may seem strange, but that's what was playing in my house when I was a kid, and that's what I love.
Was that kind of weird in England?
That was kind of weird, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
That was kind of cute, and it was kind of weird.
Would I sound like a Valley girl? That's weird. Thank God this isn't a real radio show.
Yeah.
No, that's good.
You did that for a second.
That's why we do this show, so I can learn to not talk like a Valley girl. Yeah. Was that weird in England, country music?
It was a bit, yeah. It was just both my parents are musicians and country fans, and it was just something that was playing a lot in the car, and it was just the first music that I listened, that I remember hearing and loving.
Your dad is actually Richard Thompson, and he's on the record as well.
He plays guitar in a few songs, yeah.
When you're working with him, when you're collaborating with him, is he just the guitar player of the day? Or do you have the relationship of, this is my dad, and I need to talk to him in that relationship we have?
It's more like a guitar player. It's I don't know. I mean, he's very professional. He's not somebody you need to tell him what to play anyway, so it's more like you just come in and chat, and it's nice to see my dad, and then you hit play, and then he does what he does, and you don't need to give him a lot of direction.
One of the things I really liked when I was listening to the CD was, I love a lot of this. There's lots of strings.
Yeah, there's a lot of strings
on the record. Let's play a little bit so people can hear it, and then we can talk about it.
Okay.
Must have had a change of heart. You don't treat me like you did at the start. Your campaign of love was quite a work of art. Now I guess
as you can imagine, the name of that song is Change of Heart from Teddy Thompson's new record, Up Front and Down Low. Teddy, so in terms of bringing in all these lush strings, everything else is really sparse. Why did you make that decision?
I wanted to do something a little different. I wanted to do these country songs, and it was a fun project to do, but I sort of hit upon this idea as we were getting into it, of having a string quartet and quite a non-country sounding string quartet. So having country songs but with very European sounding strings, sort of Baroque sounding strings. And we had this wonderful string arranger in England do them called Robert Kirby, who's famous for doing the Nick Drake records in the 70s. So he sort of added a different dimension, and it became something a little more interesting than just some dude doing country songs.
Some dude doing country songs. Well, some dude was producing this record as well.
Yeah.
What was challenging about producing yourself?
Probably not being able to say no to myself because I'm so irresistible. there's a little bit of, there's nobody really to make decisions except for me, which is hard. At some point you'd like turn around to someone and just say, what should I do? But that person is actually me. So that's the main challenge. You've got to self-edit and self-decide. That's not a phrase. You know what I'm saying? I'm just turning my cell phone off here because I had this ESP that I was going to get an important phone call, and I thought that's not good.
All right. Well, now that your cell phone's turned off, can you play it soon?
Well, exactly. Yeah, sure. So this song is called Down Low, which is the song I wrote on the record, and it's the down low part of Up Front and Down Low. Okay.
love. I've been thinking of you and the things I used to do and the trouble I made. You'd be better off dead with a bullet in your head and come back to me. Keep it on the down low. Tell everybody you know I loved you more than I showed. But I'm only a man, my pride makes demands. Only ever lead me to sorrow. So burn all the letters I sent, for every word that I meant. Hell to that blood. Forget every nice thing I said. There are thoughts in my head that would make you cry. Keep it on the down low. Don't tell everybody you know I loved you more than I showed. But I'm only a man, pride makes demands, only ever lead me to sorrow. Oh, I was making you sad. I have a heart, but it's bad. Keep it on the down low. Don't tell everybody you know I loved you more than I showed. But I'm only pride makes demands, only ever lead me to sorrow. So long. good luck try to grow. Break the habits I show. I still got time. And find someone who cares for you and himself. I still got time.
I'm totally understanding why girls go in for singer-songwriters. Because I kind of want to give you my number right now.
You want to hang out later?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll give you a Valley Girl just, impression that'll blow your mind.
We'll go for a drink. Whatever happens, happens.
Should I leave you two alone?
Yeah.
Sure, maybe. Teddy Thompson playing off of his new album, Up Front and Down Low. Your parents are both pretty well-known musicians, and I was kind of reading up on you the last couple of days, and everywhere I see you mentioned, a lot of times there's a reference to your folks. Has that been something that has been kind of annoying, or is it something that has, you know, it's nice to have somebody in the family who kind of knows from music?
Yeah, a bit, but it's never really annoying. You know, I come from they're folk musicians, and I come from that sort of English folk musician background thing where it's actually a good thing to have family that's all, there's a big tradition of it, there's a lot of families that sing and play, so it's sort of something to be celebrated where I come from, so I don't see it as being a burden.
Right, but you don't feel like, I've read a lot of, like I said, in stories that are about you, they'll talk about what an amazing musician your dad is, particularly mm-hmm. his guitar work is just, I mean, it's like legendary.
Yeah.
And then I even read someone said, Teddy, he's a competent guitar player. Uh-huh. Yeah. So, like, come on, I'm, you know, don't compare me to my dad all the time.
Well, I mean, a little bit, but you know, also, I was very aware from when I was a kid that, you know, that my dad is about as good as it gets in playing the guitar. So it's not really something that I ever aspired to getting as good as him at, if you know what I mean. And my mother is a great singer as well, so I never really thought I was going to eclipse them in those direct comparisons, you know.
Yeah.
So no, not too much. I mean, once in a while you get bored of the same question, but only because it's the same question. If somebody asked me what my favorite color was every day in an interview, I might get sick of that as well.
Okay, I'm going to take that off the list. No color talk. Yeah. Well, you know, I just want to make sure we can get another song in here as we're sort of running up against it. So I know you. I understand you got another number.
Yeah.
The record that you're going to play,
I'm eagerly
awaiting. I got so excited yesterday when I realized this song, if it's the song I'm thinking of.
I was asked to play
George Jones.
Yeah, it's a George Jones
song. I got
song.
So excited yesterday when I saw this was on the record. So
yeah, it's a great song. So here we go.
Just because I ask a friend about her, just because I spoke her name somewhere, just because I rang her number care, just because I haunt the same old places where the memories of her linger everywhere. Just because I'm not the happy guy I used to be. care. But if she's happy thinking I still need her, well, let that silly notion bring her cheer. But how could she ever be so it's a chain idea. Just because I ask a friend about her, just because I spoke her name somewhere, because I saw her then went all to pieces. She thinks I still care. She thinks I care.
Teddy, when we hear you play, I can't imagine you doing anything else for a living.
I can do it all.
Well, I mean, for a living. My question is,
for living.
Did you ever have, was there anything else you ever thought you wanted to do in your life besides being a musician?
Not much, no. I didn't have, but not because I was ultra passionate until later. I mean, I'm into it, whatever. Mm-hmm. But
quit hounding me. I'm into it.
I'm into it. I like doing this. It's fun. But I don't have any other skills. I never had anything else I was really good at that sort of competed for my attention. You know, some people are good. Some musicians are good artists and stuff as well, and they think. But I never had anything like that. So I was all eggs in one basket.
Well, it's a pretty good basket.
Okay, good eggs, good basket.
Yeah. Good eggs, good basket. That's what they say about me.
Sure.
Let me give you, can I give you a little plug for what's happening in your life in the next week? Because you're going to be kind of busy.
Yeah, on Tuesday I'll be having breakfast at...
And then in the evening you can go to Mo Pit Kittens, where you have your record release party, and then Letterman Wednesday night.
Yes, Letterman Wednesday.
Have you done that before?
No. Sorry, I forget.
It's going to be like this, except people will actually see you and hear you.
All right, so
but
similar.
It's kind of glamorous, like being on the Bryant Park Project.
Cool. Yeah.
Philadelphia, you get to see them at Tin Angel on the 28th. Madison, Wisconsin, on August 8th, and Chicago. Oh, you're playing Shubas. I like Shubas. August 10th.
Mm. Yes.
All right, Teddy Thompson. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
The name of the record is Up Front and Down Low.
And speaking of down low, the clock is getting very down low to the end of our second real show. I don't know if this is going to make Matt mad, but Teddy, could you just play us out with a little music as we say goodbye from the Bryant Park Project?
As we watch David Beckham.
Yeah. Focus on the soccer in a minute there, Broseph. All right, this is the Bryant Park Project. Thanks so much for listening.
You finally said something good when you said goodbye. So don't wait around to see if I'm going to cry. Instead of tears streaming down my face, I find a great big smile in the place. You finally said something good when you said goodbye. Don't want to rush you, babe, but I'll help you pack. I've been waiting for you to make a move like that. Don't waste your time on goodbyes, dear. You've already said I want to hear. You finally said something good when you said goodbye. faster, I'll call a cab. Don't worry about the fare, I'll pay the tab. You've been talking and talking all these years. You finally said what I want to hear. You finally said something good when you said goodbye. You finally said something good when you said goodbye. So don't wait around to see if I'm gonna cry. You've been talking and talking all these years. You finally said what I wanna hear. You finally said something good when you said goodbye. You finally said something good when you said goodbye.
Damn right.